We'll hear argument next in case 08-1107, the Hertz Corporation versus Friend. Mr. Srinivasan.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The diversity statute deems a corporation a citizen of, quote, the state where it has its principal place of business, close quote. The Ninth Circuit erred in holding that petitioner Hertz is a citizen of California, even though Hertz is headquartered in New Jersey and conducts over 80% of its operations outside the state of California, and even though, under the court's approach, national corporations could regularly be deemed California citizens if they conduct operations in that state that are proportional to the state's population. The better reading of the statute, in our view, is that it points to the location of a corporation's headquarters, the site from which a corporation directs and controls all of the company's operations throughout all of its locations. And that's particularly the correct reading when the statutory language is considered in light of two considerations. First, the strong preference for simplicity and ease of administration in jurisdictional rules. And second, Congress's purposes in 1958, to preserve diversity jurisdiction for corporations in 48 states, and to deny access to diversity jurisdiction only in one state, the state where the corporation has its home or principal place of business. Now, with respect to the ordinary meaning of the statutory text, the critical phrase is principal place of business, and dictionary definitions of that term define the term principal place of business as corporate headquarters, and that's fortified by federal and state laws, which also define the term as company's headquarters.
Counsel, the problem with every test is that you can find an exception that makes the application ridiculous. Let's assume that we accept that headquarters or nerve center may have some applicability to a corporation that has a business in a variety of different states.
Sure.
All right. That your situation is perhaps the most attractive.
Right.
Because whether California has 20% and Florida 14% or 15%, to me the differences are not terribly substantial. I could imagine McDonald's having 1% in every part of the world, and how you choose then, California would say then you go back to headquarters, but I don't know why you start there. But let's posit the simpler situation. Headquarters in New Jersey, but everything else is in California. Your test would ignore completely that, and it depends on how you define headquarters. If they have three corporate executives, that's the entire extent, or let's say one corporate executive who started the company, and he lives in New Jersey, and he flies out to California half the time and runs the business from there but happens to live in New Jersey, then you would say diversity is still New Jersey, correct?
We would, Your Honor, but let me start first with accepting Your Honor's premise that in the situation of a multi-state corporation with dispersed operations, the principal place of business would be the headquarters. Now, I take your point that there are situations in which the test may not seem so straightforward, but we think even in the hypothetical that Your Honor posits, the better answer, at least our first submission would be the better answer, is the headquarters would control. And that's for a couple of reasons. Although, again, the one exception we would have to our rule is exactly Your Honor's hypothetical, and let me just bracket that. Now, the reason we think first and
foremost— But you haven't articulated, at least to me, a meaningful principle in which to set that exception. It has to be tied somehow to the test and why the test in some situations would have applicability and others may not.
Sure. And let me
I don't know the difference between one headquarters and two places to do business or three, but I can still see that some factoring has to be done when the places of business are more limited.
Well, we think first and foremost that the headquarters rule would apply even in Your Honor's situation, and I'll get to the exception, fashioning the exception in 1 second.
But your case doesn't call for that judgment because you have a multi-state corporation, and I assume you would be satisfied with saying that when a corporation has dispersed operations, it doesn't have its business center or its headquarters, doesn't have its business center dominant in any one state, but it's dispersed, then you take the headquarters because there's no way to pick choose all the others, and it certainly isn't worth the labor to try to do that. So you could have a rule that says dispersed across many states, you pick headquarters. And that, you don't have to urge anything further.
No, absolutely, Justice Ginsburg, and we would certainly accept a resolution of the case in that light. If the court were to announce a rule that says multi-state corporations with dispersed operations, the principal place of business in that situation is the headquarters. I think Your Honor is correct that certainly we would prevail under that
rule. Well, why would we say that? Just because it went your case and solves the problem? I mean, it seems to me to do that, you abandon your principal argument, which is that place doesn't mean state.
Right.
And to talk about the whole state of California as the principal place of doing business. I mean, if Congress meant that, it would have said the principal state in which business is done.
That's correct, Justice Scalia.
You don't want to throw away that good argument.
We certainly don't want to throw it away. We certainly don't. Well, first and foremost, we'd like to prevail. And I think even under the narrow approach,
you would never get to the California thing about state. If you say multi-state, you pick the place. The headquarters is the place. It's within a state.
Yes, and that's why we would accept that result, Justice Ginsburg. We certainly would. Let me just put that out there first and foremost.
Now, were you done with your answer to Justice Sotomayor's hypothetical?
I don't know that I, in fact, started the answer, Mr. Chief Justice, but with respect. The answer is that even in that situation, for the reasons that Justice Scalia highlights, we would say that the headquarters controls. And let me give two principal reasons why. The first is that even if the operations are in one state and the headquarters are in a different state, the headquarters still is where the direction and control comes from. And I think the ordinary meaning of the phrase principal place of business in that situation would still direct attention to the headquarters. And the dictionary definitions that we identified in our brief, and every federal and state law that defines the term principal place of business defines it at headquarters as headquarters, without any exception for the hypothetical situation that Your Honor posits.
So what constitutes headquarters?
I'm sorry?
How many executives have to live there? What else has to exist there? And then what's the default rule if those things don't exist?
Right, Your Honor, I think that's a sort of different set of questions, which is, are there ambiguities with respect to the definition of a headquarters in certain situations? Now, by and large, the headquarters is relatively straightforward. It's made in public filings, which are an easy place to look. And if you look at the experience of the Seventh Circuit, which of course has applied a headquarters approach across the board over the course of several decades, I think we can see that test has been straightforward and simple in application in the main. Now, that's not to say that there aren't issues about the definition of headquarters at the outer perimeters. There are. And I think the place I would look first and foremost is, where does direction and control for the corporation come from? That's the situs at which the headquarters would be found. And I would look also to what a corporation itself identifies as headquarters in public filings. In 10-K filings and under the Model Business Corporations Act, corporations have to report their headquarters in annual reports. And of course, they're doing those reports for reasons other than establishing jurisdiction in a particular case, so I think they come with an air of objectivity about them. That's where I'd look. Now, I'd make this other point, though, about the ambiguity that Your Honor points to with respect to the definition of a headquarters. That's not at all an ambiguity that only applies to our test, because under respondent's test and under the test of every court of appeals, they take into account the headquarters. Now, we would think that that is dispositive. The other courts consider it at least highly relevant, albeit not dispositive.
Why do the others all go through some totality of the factors test? I mean, obviously you could pick the headquarters. You say Congress wanted one place. Headquarters is a logical choice, most circuits have made it more complicated than that. So the Seventh Circuit is the only one who said, keep it simple, as you urge, headquarters. So why are the other circuits resistant to the solution that you're proposing?
Well, first, in a situation with a multi-state corporation with dispersed operations, as we point out in footnote 2 of our reply brief, I think the courts of appeals are generally in agreement that the headquarters would control in that situation. Now, with respect to whether you would have an across-the-board headquarters rule, Justice Ginsburg, I think what happened is the first court to consider this question was the Third Circuit in the Scott case pretty soon after the statute was enacted in 1958. And that court, with respect, didn't wrestle with the ordinary meaning of the statutory terms, and it didn't wrestle with the strong premium on simple and administrable jurisdictional rules. And then that doctrine sort of took on a life of its own, I think.
But they do it in different ways. Some say business operations, some say headquarters.
There's a variety of different approaches. I think all of them share the common feature that they consider essentially a totality of the circumstances, and all of them, in our view, share a common flaw.
How did the bankruptcy courts do it? I mean, you brought out that principal place of business was a term that the bankruptcy courts had been using before the amendment of 1332-1958. But I don't think that it is inevitably headquarters for the bankruptcy courts. I mean, sometimes it's another place, isn't it?
Well, the bankruptcy courts, I think the fairest assessment of the bankruptcy courts as of 1958 was that it was a muddle. Now, since then, the Collier's Treatise, for example, would tell you that the majority and predominant rule is a headquarters rule, even in the bankruptcy context. Pre-1958, I think there was a conflict. That's what the treatise has said, and that's what we explain in our brief. But there certainly were some courts that adopted a headquarters approach, even in the bankruptcy context. But I think one thing I would caution the court about is assuming that just because some courts in the bankruptcy context, because of bankruptcy-specific considerations, and the specific consideration was a felt need to have the assets of the bankrupt estate within the purview of the court so that the court could administer the estate, that Congress would have wanted to import every judicial application down to every nuanced detail in the bankruptcy context over to the jurisdictional context, where we know that Congress thought the simplicity was a real virtue. And I think, as Your Honor's opinion in Wachovia versus Schmidt a few terms ago points out, there's no reason to assume that Congress would have taken one word in the venue context and applied the exact same meaning to that same word in the jurisdictional context. And here, because of the strong preference, in favor of simplicity and administrability in jurisdictional rules, that's a particularly poignant reason why the headquarters approach in our point of view should govern in all circumstances.
Now, in the case, this is purely hypothetical, but suppose Hertz were to be bankrupt, to file a petition in bankruptcy, where New Jersey would be the place on your, or the assets are dominantly someplace else, so it would be another place?
Well, I think if what you're asking, Justice Ginsburg, is where would the principal place of business be under the bankruptcy statute, the majority rule now, and there's a Fifth Circuit case, Commonwealth Oil Refining, and a Seventh Circuit case, Peachtree, which show that the majority rule now is that the principal place of business would be New Jersey. And one point I'd like to get to in that regard is the sort of oddity of saying that the principal place of business of a company like Hertz would be somewhere other than New Jersey. And the Ninth Circuit has the view that the principal place of business of Hertz is California, based on the fact that Hertz conducts 20% of its business in California. But it's important to bear in mind that this statute is a zero-sum game, so that if Hertz is deemed to have its principal place of business in California, such that it's disabled from getting access to diversity jurisdiction in California, the consequence is that Hertz would be enabled to gain diversity jurisdiction in every other state. And I'm putting to one side Delaware, the state of incorporation. But it would be enabled to gain access to diversity jurisdiction in every other state. So the consequence would be that if Hertz were sued in a state court action in Park Ridge, New Jersey, the site of its headquarters, Hertz could get federal court jurisdiction in that jurisdiction on the theory that it's an out-of-state company, it's a California company, because it performs 21% of its business in California. Now, that the oddity of that, in our view, is particularly poignant if one takes into account a company like Walmart. Walmart is universally recognized to be an Arkansas corporation because it's headquartered in Bentonville, Arkansas. But Walmart also, it's undisputed, does substantially more business by any of the measures that the Ninth Circuit considers significant in Texas. It has more employees there, it has more stores there, it generates more revenues there by a significant factor, well in excess of 50% over and above any other state. But the consequence of deeming Walmart a Texas corporation based on the amount of business it does in Texas would be not only that Walmart would be disabled from getting federal court jurisdiction in Texas, but that Walmart would be enabled to get federal court jurisdiction in Bentonville, Arkansas, on the theory that even in Arkansas, Walmart would be an out-of-state corporation, a Texas corporation, because of the level of business that it conducts in Texas. And we don't think that's the result that Congress would have envisioned in 1958 when it enacted the principal place of business provision. Instead, what Congress presumably had in mind is that corporations, as a general matter, are identified with the location of their headquarters. So in the Walmart situation, Walmart rightly is universally acknowledged to be an Arkansas corporation because of the presence in that state of its headquarters.
Counsel, all you're talking about is not necessarily nerve center, because in reading the examples in your brief, what you're talking about is where's the place where they have the most important, significant, influential contact. Now, the Ninth Circuit has defined that as the place where business is done. You're suggesting that it's the place where the nerve center is, but it goes back to begging my question, why just simply they're declaring it on a tax form doesn't make it important, influential, or significant contact. There has to be something more to the test, and it can't be just what I declare my headquarters to be. There has to be some form of activity in that place.
There does, Your Honor. And we think, I guess the comparison I would make is to an individual. Because an individual can't declare that he or she is a domiciliary of a particular state and have it be so for citizenship purposes. There has to be something behind that, and so too with corporations.
That's the point.
Exactly, and we share that view. A corporation couldn't simply declare that its headquarters are located in a location where it has a mailbox, for example, and have that be dispositive for citizenship purposes.
Is there something to a rule that says headquarters is presumptively the nerve center, but a challenged party, whoever that is, can rebut it?
I think certainly it would be a vast improvement over what the Ninth Circuit has. So I would say that as a starting point, Your Honor. I think, in our view, of course, a principal submission is the headquarters controls in all situations. And the cost of having, you know, a rebuttable presumption would be, what does it take to rebut it? And that would be the question.
Well,
and I think
the point that I raise, which is that the headquarters is not an important, consequential, or substantial. You can rebut it if you can show that it is a shell headquarters.
Yeah, and I think in that situation, I guess there's two different ways one could look at that. One is to say that you could rebut it, but the other is to say that it's not the headquarters. And I guess that's the way that I would look at it, is to say that if the corporation identifies a location at which it in fact doesn't direct and control the operations of the corporation throughout, it wouldn't constitute the headquarters. So I guess that's where I would place the load-bearing weight. It may be semantic, but
that's the problem, which is a party comes in, alleges by summary judgment that in a summary judgment motion, this is my corporate headquarters, the other side's going to have to come forth with evidence that shows something.
Right. And if
so, there's always a rebuttable presumption.
There is, Your Honor. And if the other side were able to show that the location that the party identifies as its headquarters does not, in fact, function at a headquarters in the sense that suppose there's no executives there, or suppose that the officials that are there, in fact, don't direct and control the company's operations in other locations, well, then that would be a real issue. But there are checks against that, because corporations identify their headquarters in other public filings, and in the main, those headquarters are the locations from which the chief executives direct and control the company's operations.
I actually don't know whether public filings define what headquarters mean. Is there I know you've said it in your brief, but what I didn't know is whether those public filings define the activity necessary to designate a place of headquarters.
Well, they do in the following sense, Your Honor. For example, with the 10-K report for publicly traded companies, I think the question that's asked is not the location of the headquarters, but the location of the principal executive offices. And so I think by definition, in answering that question, the principal executives would be located at that location. Now, if they weren't, we'd certainly take Your Honor's point that there could be a back and forth about that.
But the Congress picked principal place of business. And we know that they looked at the bankruptcy courts. There are lots of expressions in other statutes. Some say headquarters. Some say, well, there are a variety of things. But Congress picked this particular term, principal place of business. And I was thinking when you gave the example of Texas, so the idea of diversity is you're not going to get a federal forum where you are at home. And so one would think, well, if Walmart is doing so much in Texas, it's really no stranger in Texas, why shouldn't there be diversity in Texas?
Well, in response to the latter point, Your Honor, I think that one thing we do know from 1958 is that Congress didn't think a corporation should be disabled from getting diversity jurisdiction anywhere where it does a substantial business, because it had that proposal before
it rejected it. Yes.
It instead chose an approach whereby a company is disabled from getting diversity jurisdiction in one and only one jurisdiction, the jurisdiction in which it has its principal place of business. And I think what Congress had in mind is that corporations as a general matter are identified with their headquarters. And that's why Walmart, for example, is universally recognized as an Arkansas company. It may be that Walmart does substantial business in Texas, substantially in excess of other states, but Walmart also does substantial business in a variety of jurisdictions. But Congress decidedly didn't have the rule that says wherever Walmart does a substantial business and is a well-recognized company, it should be disabled from getting to federal court. It limited to one jurisdiction. And we think the best reading of the phrase principal place of business is the situs of the headquarters. And now, there are, with respect to the bankruptcy decisions, Your Honor, there were were bankruptcy courts that did have a headquarters approach. And in fact, the one bankruptcy court of which I'm aware that looked at the meaning of the ordinary language, we cite the relevant the portion of the court's opinion at page 50 of our opening brief in footnote 5. It's the First Circuit's opinion in the Burdick case. And what the First Circuit said was that a corporation's, quote, principal office, rather than a factory, mill, or mine, according to ordinary understanding and speech, constitutes the principal place of business within the meaning of the bankruptcy code. And so even before 1958, I think there was definitely a sense out there that the term principal place of business does mean headquarters. And this gets to Your Honor's other question, which is, if Congress really meant headquarters, why wouldn't they have used the term headquarters instead of principal place of business? And I think our answer to that, with respect to Your Honor, is that principal place of business is an alternative formulation for headquarters. And so I don't think one can glean too much from the fact that Congress chose principal place of business rather than headquarters, when principal place of business, in our view, is a reference to the headquarters. And this Court's opinion last term in the Abu Hawa versus United States case is a good example of that, because there, the statute that was at issue used the term facilitate rather than the term aid or abet. And one could have readily made the argument that because the statute uses the term facilitate rather than aid or abet, the normal principles that accompany aiding and abetting liability shouldn't apply in the statute. But the Court rightly, in our view, reached the contrary conclusion, and it was based on the notion that the term facilitate, according to Black's Law Dictionary, means the very same thing as aid or abet. And once you cross that bridge, then you can apply aiding and abetting principles to the term facilitate. And here, likewise, the term principal place of business, according to Black's Law Dictionary, means headquarters. That's how Black's Law Dictionary defines the term. And so the fact that Congress chose one alternate formulation versus another, I don't think speaks too loudly to the
question. What of the argument that Hertz has this New Jersey headquarters, but its reservation center is in Oklahoma?
Sure, and again, I would look at the public filings. In the public filings, in the 10-K, for example, Hertz universally identifies its headquarters as Park Ridge, New Jersey. And the reason is that the chief executive officials are all located in Park Ridge. Now, there's a large administrative apparatus in Oklahoma City. And according to the affidavit, its administrative activities are performed in Oklahoma City to a lesser extent. And that's at paragraph 11 of the affidavit, which is at pages 29A to 30A of the appendix to the petition. But I don't think there's any real dispute that Hertz's main headquarters are located in Park Ridge rather than Oklahoma City. In point of fact, what you have in Oklahoma City, and this isn't spelled out in the affidavit, but what you have in Oklahoma City is essentially the rental call center and plus principal back office duties like information technology support. But what you have in Park Ridge is all of the company's chief executives. So the decision-making locus for the company's most important decisions is absolutely in Park Ridge, New Jersey, rather than Oklahoma City. And there's no dispute on the point that's before the court. This case comes to the court on the assumption that Hertz's headquarters are located in Park Ridge. The question for the court is whether that headquarters location should be dispositive for purposes of defining a company's principal place of business. Now, if I could turn for one moment to the cost in terms of simplicity and administrability of an alternative formulation, if the court were to accommodate a formulation that didn't look to the headquarters, we see three potential categories of costs that are brought about by the proposed approach of respondents and the one that the Ninth Circuit has established. The first is the one that underlies the strong preference in favor of simple and administrable jurisdictional rules, and that is just the time and resources that would be invested at the threshold jurisdictional stage in divining whether the case is before the proper court. That in itself is reason enough in our view.
Not all diversity suits have major law firms in them and a lot of resources to spend in discovery to determine a more complex test.
That's right. Yeah, that's our point, Justice Kennedy. And I think a headquarters test is simple and straightforward in that respect, and a totality circumstances approach isn't. But there's also two additional costs that I would point out about a totality of circumstances approach. One is that you could have the very real possibility, because of the indeterminacy in that approach, that different courts would reach divergent conclusions about the citizenship of the very same corporation. And as we point out on page 40 of our brief, that's already happened. Two district courts in the Ninth Circuit alone and two California courts reached divergent conclusions on the citizenship of United Airlines. One court concluded that United was an Illinois citizen, and another court concluded that United was a California citizen. And that's not altogether surprising that you would have those sorts of divergent conclusions, given the open-ended nature of a totality of circumstances approach. The third cost that I would point to is the possibility that because of the indeterminacy in the approach, you could have a situation in which a district court finds that there's jurisdiction, proceeds to have a trial on the merits and renders judgment on the merits, and then several years later, a court of appeals would reverse the judgment because the district court had gotten the jurisdictional inquiry wrong at the outset. And again, that also, as with the situation with divergent conclusions on the citizenship of the same corporation, is not just a problem of theory. It's actually happened.
Even when the direct, the even subject matter jurisdiction is precluded after final judgment, after the direct route. So that's a little extreme, the example you gave.
Well, I think, I guess my point is that precisely because subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any point.
Not any point in the direct up to denial of cert on direct review. After that, it's precluded, even subject matter jurisdiction. You can't collaterally attack on that basis.
Sure. Right. I guess my point is that you could have a situation where a trial court has reached a resolution on the merits. Several years later, the Court of Appeals on direct review would reach the conclusion that the district court got it wrong on subject matter jurisdiction. And there's a case that we cite in our briefs, the Diaz versus Pep Boys case, that involved that situation. If the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Schneider.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. For 50 years, every circuit save the Seventh has agreed on one overriding principle, that courts must perform a balancing in determining the principal place of business of a corporation. And that balancing must include a determination of where the corporation's people and property are.
Is that a fair description of what the Ninth Circuit did here? Did they perform a balancing, or did they look solely to where most of the sales were?
The Ninth Circuit specifically in this case noted that 43% more employees for Hertz are in California, 75% more property, 60% more revenue, and
more than what? More than any other single state?
That's correct, Justice Scalia.
But text doesn't say that the principal state of business is a principal place of business.
The statute does say.
Difference between the two?
I think I have two answers to that, Your Honor. The first answer is that Congress was using a term of art that was imported from the Bankruptcy Code. And all of the Bankruptcy Code cases prior to 1958, the 11 U.S.C. 11 cases, take an aggregation approach when they look at a state by state. So if we read principal place of business as a term of art that Congress imported into this statute, then we have to look at a aggregated state-by-state approach. The other answer, I think, is more of a semantic answer, which is, how did Congress define the word place? Certainly, the English language provides that a place can be a building, as Hertz would have, or a place could be a state, as we were had. My place of birth, for example, is New York State.
Why didn't they say place of doing business? That's not the terminology that they used.
They didn't, and Congress
that would be more consistent with an aggregation of all of the factors the Ninth Circuit starts with.
Your Honor, Congress chose the phrase principal place of business because, to quote the legislative history, there were many cases on the books and it was an easily understood phrase. I think what Congress intended to do was to not have us end up here, to take a phrase which was known in the case law and to import
counsel, what's very clear from all of the articles I've read in the lower court decisions is that Congress may have thought it was picking a well-defined phrase, but in fact it wasn't. That the courts below were confused about what they were doing before the statute. So I don't know why importing the belief that something was clear into a reality that it's not helps us.
Your Honor, in answer to Justice Scalia's question, I believe it was clear from all of the case law that we were talking about place equaling an aggregation of all of the activity in the state. With regard to your question, we have cited in our brief two district court opinions that performed a scholarly review of all of the case law at the time that Congress passed the 1958 amendments. Particularly of import is the Inland Rubber case. And what the court found in the Inland Rubber case is while there was two lines of thinking, there was the what came to be known as the nerve center line of thinking and what came to be known as the business realities line of thinking, the nerve center tests could almost all be explained by the fact that in those cases, the corporation only had one place of business. There were some outliers. But for the most part, the two judges in the Ghilardi case and in the Inland Rubber case.
So why do you think that the circuit courts, the vast majority of them, the third, the first, the second, the fifth, they all start with the proposition that if a place has far-flung businesses, then the nerve center test should start the inquiry and control it more than in a situation where there are lesser places of business?
Yes, that's the total activities test, Your Honor. And the total activities test would put initial weight on the nerve center. But if one, and then of course weigh whether or not there's a substantial predominance of all of the other factors somewhere in the country, which frankly is not a lot different than the Ninth Circuit test. The Ninth Circuit simply does it in the other way. It asks the
same. Well, that's a big difference.
It asks the same question, whether or not there's a substantial predominance. If it finds substantial predominance, not just predominance, but substantial predominance.
I'm, you know, to me the word substantial usually means closer to 50%. I'm having a hard time understanding what the appreciable difference is between 20% and 14% and the balance being spread over so many other places. That seems very arbitrary in terms of the place that generates the most money, that's it. That's the place you're at home.
I think to understand it, one must look to the purpose of diversity. The real question is diversity to be used as a sword by a corporation such that the corporation can choose its place of diversity jurisdiction, or is it a shield to protect the corporation, a truly foreign corporation, from local bias?
Well, But that goes back to the point. If we're talking about shields or swords, Congress had before it a provision that would say anywhere you do business, you're not a foreigner because you're there. The people are going to perceive you as a business, the local business that is doing business in that location, and Congress rejected that. So foreign had to have a meaning that was somewhat different. And you don't think the corporate headquarters, where management is, where the direction for the operation of the business is coming from, is the place that needs the most protection in this system because they're the ones making the decisions? And so aren't they the ones who need to be protected from local bias?
Courts have found that corporations are best known where they have most of their people and their property. That's because employees go out in the community, property is sold, bought and sold in the community. So the local people will know the corporation more where they have their people and property than necessarily where they have the headquarters. Until this case began, I had no idea where Hertz headquarters are. There's many corporations in the state of California that I have no idea are headquartered in the state of California.
The problem with your approach, and California is unique in this respect, is California is a very large state, lots of business, and you are comparing to the next state that has the next number of employee sales, Florida. If I were entertaining your approach, I would think, well, you would compare California against the whole rest of the nation and not pick for dispersed. A corporation is widely dispersed. California is going to be the big winner in this. It's going to be able to keep all those cases in its state courts because so many multi-state corporations, I imagine, would come out just the way Hertz does. Am I right that on your analysis, the one place where if you'd say, we don't want federal courts to be dealing with corporations that are at home in the state, but in the state of New Jersey, under your view of things, a New Jersey citizen could sue Hertz in federal court in New Jersey, right?
That is correct, Your Honor, unless, of course, Hertz were to change its place of incorporation to New Jersey.
And why do you say, well, why is the Ninth Circuit's method California versus Florida instead of California, and let's see what the rest of the business is in the whole United States?
I think the answer, Justice Ginsburg, to that question goes back to how the phrase principal place of business was looked at under the bankruptcy code. And in the bankruptcy code, it was, in fact, a state-by-state analysis rather than a state versus country analysis. Now, Justice Ginsburg, you asked me, did it mean that all corporations were going to end up being California corporations? California, the Ninth Circuit has been doing it this way for 50 years. Every other circuit has had, save the Seventh, has had some balancing test for 50 years. And it has not come to pass that all corporations are California corporations. A matter of fact, if you think of a corporation that sells skis, they're likely going to be a Colorado corporation, or they're going to be a Utah corporation. A corporation that sells mining equipment is likely to end up in West Virginia or one of the mining states.
I don't understand why somehow a Californian is more likely to identify with Hertz simply because there are more Californians and hence more Hertz outlets than a New Jerseyite is likely to identify with Hertz. Per capita, there are probably as many Hertz outlets in New Jersey as there are in California. The only reason you come up with California is it's an enormous state. It has 10% of the population. But as far as the citizens of the state identifying with that company, and therefore the unfairness of letting that company, removed to federal court, New Jersey and California are absolutely the same.
Congress made a decision in rejecting the any place where you're doing business test that it would not prevent corporations from removing cases in any state where they're doing business. The question in diversity jurisdiction is not whether or not a corporation should be allowed to use the federal form because it decides that that's the best form for it, but the question is a different one. Will there be bias in the state court? And because Hertz does so much business in California, it's hard to argue that we'll be biased by being in state court in California. Remember this case.
But they're not going to be biased by the state court in New Jersey either. You correctly pointed out that Congress said place of business. It didn't do as it did with corporate citizenship. That is, you could be a citizenship of as many states as you incorporate in. But it's got to be one place. So why not just keep it simple and say, presumptively, it's the business headquarters. In a particular case, you could show otherwise.
Congress had two goals, Justice Ginsburg. The first goal was to prevent gaming of the system. The simplest test is also the most easily gamed.
That would be a phony headquarters. But nobody is suggesting that the headquarters of Hertz in New Jersey, that's a sham setup.
But even a real headquarters wouldn't prevent gaming of the system. If a corporation truly wanted to stay out of a state court in a state where it was doing significant business, even all of their business under Hertz test, they would only have to actually move their headquarters out of that state. There's a second reason that Congress passed the 58.
Is that a phenomenon? I mean, I can see that as a hypothetical, but does it happen in the real world that a corporation moves its headquarters in order to escape the federal courts in a particular state?
Because the test is only a Seventh Circuit test, it wouldn't do any good for a corporation to do so.
Well, it's one of the factors in other states as well. It's part of the totality of the circumstances.
It is.
Certainly increase your odds to move your headquarters.
It would, but it wouldn't be dispositive. We do know that corporations move for all sorts of economic reasons. They move for tax reasons. They move.
But why would they move simply to avoid the federal court or to gain access to the federal court in a particular state?
There is, as witnessed by congressional findings in the Class Action Fairness Act, there is a perception that state courts in certain states are not good for corporations. Whether that perception is a real perception or whether it's not a real perception isn't for us today. But if a corporation has all of its people and all of its property and is doing all of its business in one of those states, a corporation shouldn't be allowed to game the system by simply moving its headquarters.
Well, we're not talking about all of all. I mean, that would be, that's why you make it a presumption that headquarters is the presumption, which could be rebutted. But you're not talking about all business. You're talking about California with a sizable amount of business simply because of the size of the state, the population of the state. And I would understand your position better if you'd say, well, we measure it against the entire United States, but California's going to come out the winner much more often than any other state under this test simply because of its size.
With respect, Justice Ginsburg, I don't believe that the case law has borne that out. Again, I've read no studies that say corporations are more often California citizens simply because of the population in California under the test. Doesn't mean the study doesn't exist. I simply haven't read it.
We don't worry about private individuals gaming the system, do we, by, you know, in order to get into or out of federal court, establishing residence in a different state?
We do.
Don't worry about their gaming the system, do we?
We do, Justice Scalia. There's a very fact-intensive test for citizenship for individuals based on their intent to stay in a place.
Sure. But you can have a genuine intent to go somewhere else, and I don't know that people do it for forum reasons, because they want to get in or out of federal court. You really don't worry about that, it seems to me.
I do believe it's less likely that an individual would either have the sophistication or, frankly, the litigation volume to make such a decision. But a corporation may, in fact.
I know some rich individuals that might have the incentive.
I'd like to turn, if I may, to the second reason that Congress passed the 58 amendments, and that was because of the notion of overcrowding of the federal docket. Because there were too many diversity cases, because most litigation was happening far away from the facts. Suits involving corporations generally arise where they have a lot of contacts with the public, where their people are and where their property are. If we allow a corporation to move all of its litigation, where the bulk of its people and property are, to federal court, Congress's second goal.
Mr. Schneider, can I just inject this thought? It goes back to Justice Kennedy's question. I don't think we're just concerned about the defendants gaming the system. I think one of the very important concern is plaintiffs sometimes in small communities want to sue somebody, and sometimes they'd much rather be in federal court because sometimes the judges are better than the local judges and so forth. So there are a lot of reasons why plaintiffs want to get into federal courts. And it seems to me it's important to have a rule that makes it easy for the plaintiff to decide what is the citizenship of the defendant. Can I get into federal court or not? And it seems there's a great argument in favor of a very simple rule to benefit plaintiffs.
Again, for 50 years, Justice Stevens, plaintiffs and plaintiffs' lawyers have been able to, under the various tests, figure out where corporations are citizen.
But you must acknowledge that it's a lot easier for a plaintiff. There's some place to get on the internet and say, where is their principal place of business? And you get a simple answer. If you get a question, well, I've got to analyze their business all over the country to decide, that's a formidable obstacle for a plaintiff to overcome.
It may or may not be, depending upon the corporation. The vast majority of corporations are local corporations. So we're really just talking about
The large corporations with an interstate business who are commonly defendants in a lot of lawsuits, Brooklyn and Tracy. And the question is, can I easily decide what the place of incorporation of that defendant is?
That's correct, Justice Stevens. And because most of those entities are public corporations, there's a lot of information available in SEC filings, et cetera, as to where they're actually doing business. You can also simply look out your door and figure out whether, have I seen a lot of Hertz outlets where I am?
Where is, under the Ninth Circuit test, what is the principal place of business of Starbucks?
Under the Ninth Circuit test, the principal place of Starbucks, there's a case that says Starbucks is in California. And let me give you, Mr. Chief Justice.
That's a surprise.
I was surprised as well, but but let me give you the numbers so that it makes sense, because I've read the case.
Where is this headquarters?
Headquarters is in Seattle, Washington. But over... that's correct,
that's
Your Honor.
The very first little shop was there.
That's my understanding, yes. However, over 100% more workers from Starbucks are in California than Washington.
Could you tell me what 100% means? Are the number of workers in Seattle inconsequential? Is there one worker there, or are we talking about 1,000 in?
I don't know the total numbers of the
Isn't
work.
Isn't that important? Because Justice Scalia said that you could per capita, California is going to dwarf anybody anywhere if you're going to have a multi-location place, business. So don't you have to know the raw numbers?
I don't know the raw numbers from Starbucks. I'm sorry. I just read the opinion. And what the opinion tells us is that Starbucks has 10% of its employees in Washington and 27% in California. Over 300% more of its gross revenue comes from California than any other state. 200% more of its retail stores are in California than any other state.
What about, I guess, mail order houses? I mean, what's the principal place of business of Eddie Bauer?
It would be, Your Honor, wherever there is a substantial predominance of its people and property. I would assume, and I don't know the facts of Eddie Bauer, but I assume Eddie Bauer has a central location from which it does its sales, which it does its factory work, where it ships things.
Would it make a difference if, say, it may well be the case, 30% of their business is in California?
No, but by business you mean revenue, Your Honor?
Yeah.
The test we posit, Your Honor, focuses on people and property. The test would look first to the location of employees, tangible properties, and production activities, and then second to income earned, purchases made, and where sales take place. Mr. Chief Justice, did the court have interest in the jurisdictional argument?
I don't know. I can only speak for one member of the court, and that one doesn't.
Okay. Then if the court has any questions about our jurisdictional argument, I'll be happy to answer them. Without further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Srinivasan, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Your Honor, just one point, and I'll be brief. The idea that corporations would switch their location to their headquarters in order to achieve jurisdictional results hasn't been borne out in any example of which I'm aware, and there's a fundamental reason why. When a corporation decides to relocate its headquarters, it's making a very important business decision about what is the location from which its direction and control is going to emanate. That's not a gamesmanship decision. That's a bona fide decision about where its headquarters are going to be located and where its most important business decisions are going to be made.
It means that its principal officers and their families have to move.
It does.
That's the big disincentive, it seems to me.
Absolutely, Justice Scalia. The court has no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.